You're listening to the Shared Security Show, exploring the trust you put in people and technology with your hosts, Tom Esten, Scott Wright, and Kevin Johnson. Welcome to episode 224 of the Shared Security Show. And joining me this week, I have the privilege of having a very special guest on the show today. And that special guest is Josh Feinblum, who is the president, COO, and co-founder of Stavvy. Welcome to the show, Josh.
Thanks for having me. Tom and I were talking right before we started recording about how long it's been since since we caught up. And I mean, we spent meaningful time together back in the day, and then just, you know, poof, it's amazing.
Like, yeah.
It blows my mind.
OWASP AppSec DC, I think was
2009.
Yeah, 2009. Oh my gosh, we were a lot younger back then.
Yeah, let me just say, last time I saw you, you didn't have white hair.
Oh, I have white hair now. You do after all those years. It's you can't stop aging, unfortunately.
Not yet.
No, not yet. Maybe you could start a startup that will stop aging for all of us as your next adventure.
I like starting companies that have potential to make money in, you know, the relatively near future.
Yes, yes. So it's great having you on the show. I know we haven't talked in a long time, but maybe for our audience, can you maybe talk a little bit about yourself and your background and this thing called Stavvy?
Yeah, I mean, I always start with I am a lifelong technologist. I started writing code when I was about 10, although I never called myself an engineer. And pretty quickly thereafter, I got involved in the security community well before we would call it that, and spent the next 25 years of my life from young adulthood well into my career at what I like to call the intersection of technology and evil. I hope Kevin doesn't sue
if
me.
If Kevin was here, that'd be, professionally evil.
Yeah, I did not say I'm professionally evil, Kevin, so call the lawyers off. It was a journey. I mean, it wasn't just technical security work. It was trust and safety, fraud and abuse, privacy, legal and law enforcement operations. And, you know, so really, and then ultimately being, you know, being able to be a part of the teams that were taking or getting a couple of companies, really, you know, wonderful technology companies ready to go public. And then, you know, I went to MIT to get my MBA. I went through their executive program and I met a bunch of people there, obviously. And then the December after we graduated, one of my classmates who started a law firm a couple decades ago, that's now one of the largest transactional real estate firms in New England, and they own some title companies around the country as well, basically asked me if I wanted to work on a tech startup with him. You know, I've always been entrepreneurial. I've always wanted to do a startup. I had been tiring for several years of the security industry for many reasons. never really had an interest in trying to start a security company. And so after working with them on a little bit, it became pretty clear that we were good partners, and that we were working to transform some really important industries and industries that needed transforming. And so it became a no-brainer. So I hung up the keyboard. I don't think I'm allowed to say that because I didn't actually hang up the keyboard, but uh-huh. I hung up the professionally evil TM keyboard and started Stavvy with Costa.
Nice, nice. And let's be honest, I totally understand why you started that business, because mortgage processing, all of that paperwork and everything, that's just it's a nightmare, right? If you ever buy a house, anyone will tell you, at least maybe before you guys were created, it was a nightmare.
Yeah, still, and if you think it's bad for the consumer, wait till you get behind into what happens in the post-closing and the capital markets and the servicing and all that stuff. I mean, we're burning millions of acres of trees a year right now, and driving God knows millions of miles. For shipping, packages. I mean, Tom, there's literally parts of this process where somebody somewhere prints a document, packages it, ships it, And then it's received by somebody who opens the package, scans it in, right? Like, if only there was a way printing 100 pages and priority overnighting a document, across the country, or at least across the state, probably more frequently.
Yeah.
Like, if only there was a way, right, that we could transmit it electronically in a safe way. I don't know. If anybody invents that, they're going to be rich.
Yeah, they would be. Wow. If we only had that technology. Jeez. I guess that leads me to like just ask you a question about like obviously with what you're trying to do there. I mean, there's obviously privacy and cybersecurity things you have to think about. And I think your background, you were a CISO in the past. Whether or not you loved being a CISO, probably debatable. But did that give you kind of the experience you needed to think about how you would integrate cybersecurity and privacy into what you're trying to build?
Totally. I mean, first, I did love being a CISO. It's just an exhausting job.
Yeah.
And it's exhausting because we live in a world where people still view that role as, you know, a B or C level executive.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like somebody who is a CFO and runs finance could, you know, may not be typical, but nobody would bat an eye if the HR function reported to them, right?
Right.
Why? Because they're leaders. But the CISO, nope. Like, and you're still seeing a change, but I loved the job. I loved the people I worked with. I mean, I spent like a lifetime, almost an entire career doing it. So I don't want to come off. I was just ready. I was ready for something new.
Sure. Yeah.
I frequently say that we're working with some of the most regulated entities in America who are facilitating arguably the most regulated consumer facing transactions in the world.
Yeah.
Certainly privacy and security plays a role in that. Some of the most significant areas of cybercrime that continue to expand in the wire fraud arena heavily target this world. I think being a security practitioner offers two benefits. The first is if you're really good, and I don't want to imply that I was really good, but I don't think I was terrible. So let me just say, if you're a decent practitioner, if you're working across industries, you very quickly get adept at learning how each of these industries operates, at being able to pick apart, you know, how the systems that connect these industries work. You don't get intimidated when you're going from healthcare to education to banking, because you've seen, you know, almost every flavor. And so even though you're looking through one lens, right, the hard part isn't actually for many people applying that one lens. It is the sense making about what you're looking at. And so I think from us bringing the ability to tear apart, right, you know, how each of these industries operates and then get into this, you know, new behemoth, the security background, it made me a lot less intimidated about the fact that there's a lot of stuff I didn't know, because that's just how we always operate in the security industry. And then, you know, we also know how technology works, right? Again, we're looking through a different lens, but knowing how to build, technology, and teams that, the teams that work on technical problems, and how to create teams that have a great culture. Like, none of that's just exclusive to security. It is beneficial, right, to be able to jump on the phone with prospective customers and be able to talk through, you know, what we're doing from a security perspective, and to be able to do it probably better than any of our competitors, just because it's what I've always done. And to be able to bake security in, and there's a lot of things, both culture, security. Like, if you're stupid enough to take something called risk capital, you need to believe that you can build a multi-billion dollar business, or you shouldn't take risk capital. And if you're stupid enough to believe that, then you should say, okay, like, what do we learn in security? Right? We learn it's a lot easier to start with it than to come in, you know, when you're 400 employees and say, now it matters. Same thing goes with culture. And so really being able to bake that stuff in from the beginning, and just sometimes it's as simple as talking and thinking about it. It makes a huge difference.
So what is one thing that comes to mind in terms of like, what was your biggest challenge when it comes to cybersecurity and privacy when you were building Stavvy?
It's a good question. Cause I don't know that I don't have a good answer for you to what was my biggest challenge, because I think, like, for a few reasons. One, we were well capitalized. So very early on, I think within our first 35 or 40 employees, I hired somebody I'd known for 15 years, who's our vice president of trust and security, right? And so, and now Stavvy's 142 employees, and we have 12 people in our trust and security team. And so when you have that type of capital, she's also responsible for site reliability. And so when you're able to blend those two things together, and you're able to invest like that in a function, it's kind of unfair for me to like, say, oh, get money, right? Like it's kind of a cop out. Yeah. And there's a lot of people that are going to be trying to build, security teams at startups where they're not as well capitalized or not able to secure as much budget as we've allocated here. It's always just the same thing. Go back to the basics, right? From the very beginning, like everything needs two-factor authentication, right? It's basically like, don't do stupid shit that we know hurts us, right? But we can't, the majority of our careers are going into like these huge enterprises and trying to undo, decades of mistakes, right? Avoid those mistakes from the beginning, because it very rarely is a substantial tax to do that.
Yeah.
And so if you're a security practitioner, there are basics, like create an environment as much as possible where like patching is change, like patching the base AMI and then watching is like the rest of your environment magically patches, right? Like building horizontally scalable, decentralized, cloud-based ecosystems. Like, don't set up Active Directory.
Right? Yeah, number one.
like no Active Directory, right? Like, all Macs. That's not a statement that one's more secure than the other, but it certainly means no jerk's going to come in a few years later and set up Active Directory,
right?
And so it's going back to the basics, and like, doesn't matter how long you've been in security, like there are certain things that you know are wrong and they're bad. And if you start from the beginning and you just tell people how it's going to, like, this is necessary and why, then people are joining, they're joining an environment where those basics are in place. You can tell me if you disagree, but to me, the most painful part of the job always was going into places and having to undo, 5, 10, 15 years of mistakes.
So imagine this scenario. You're out of the office unexpectedly, and a colleague pings you because they need access to some system you have credentials for. Now, our listeners would never send passwords over email or Slack, right? But what about your coworkers? How many organizations out there are sending logins back and forth in plain text? Worse yet, how many just store all of their logins on a shared spreadsheet? We all know that human errors are the biggest threat to your organization's security. But did you know that weak or stolen passwords account for over 80% of all data breaches? Now, there are tools out there that can allow you to share credentials, set access permissions, and monitor the dark web for stolen logins. And Keeper Security's Enterprise Password Management Platform does just that. Keeper locks down logins, payment cards, confidential documents, API keys, and database passwords in a patented zero-knowledge encrypted vault. And it takes less than an hour to deploy across your organization. Sign up for a Keeper free trial for your organization today and get a free 3-year personal plan. Stop sharing emails and spreadsheets with the keys to the kingdom. Get started by visiting keepersecurity.com/sharedsecurity.
You want your organization to be secure and compliant and to have a healthy culture, but your employees' lack of awareness makes you vulnerable to data theft, fraud, and compliance penalties. It's frustrating that the boring, static training content that's being used today has failed to improve employees' ability to defend against cyber attacks. At ClickArmor, we know that without using gamification, it's extremely hard to get staff to understand how to avoid threats. Our gamified simulations and challenges have provided a 50% average improvement in thousands of employees' ability to spot phishing threats. Go to clickarmor.ca/sharedsecurity to get your free gamified phishing assessment for up to 500 employees. You'll see quickly how gamified simulations can help your team be more resilient and compliant and help avoid costly ransomware and fraud incidents. Let ClickArmor help you go from being an underappreciated, stressed out fall guy to being an innovative leader who's the catalyst for greater productivity in your organization.
That kind of leads me to a question about just talking with other startups. And I did work, I worked for Veracode for 5 years, and that was a startup as well, and then was acquired 3 times. And so went through a journey. But I always remember, like, one of the biggest challenges that we saw in cybersecurity with these companies was tech debt, right? You start building a system, and then you start adding things, and it gets complicated, and new developers come in, new leadership, and all of that. Like, how does a a startup start thinking about, like, from the beginning? Like, how do you build an environment that doesn't end up having so much tech debt that it becomes like a security and a privacy nightmare to manage?
Well, that supposes there's a way. Like, you have to be first honest, which is when you're an early stage startup, like, it is a fight for survival, right? It's as simple as that. And so, again, like, I don't want to cop out and say you go back to the basics, but because no, like, it doesn't matter what you do, there's going to be tech debt. The question is how can you, like, what can you do that minimizes tech debt that can cause the type of pain that you're discussing, right? And that's really hard. It's really hard for an early stage company or any company that's growing very, very quickly. And I almost want to say, like, fantasy land hard. I think the better question is, how do you make sure that you're addressing your tech debt at a cadence that doesn't mean that all of a sudden 4 years from now, you're going to be left with 2 years of work to, you know, undo a bunch of stuff. We've definitely made decisions and assumptions and things that over the past, you know, 2.5-3 years have led us to have projects where we've had to, like, step back and slow down, you know, important work to make sure that the product can scale. And I honestly don't know how to give advice, right? Because to that question, because I will say one thing about not being the CISO here is, I was just talking with Sarah, who is our VP of Trust and Security, a few hours ago about this, which is, you know, it is like I have a lot more respect for the challenges that many of the executives that I've worked for in the past have faced, where, like, things as a CISO that are frustrating, like, I get now, like, I understand, because you're a lot of times you're forced to make impossible trade-offs. You know, for us, knowing the types of transactions that we're facilitating, and the capital structure that we have, like, we invest in it. And, like, if we have to stop for six weeks and redirect, you know, 3/4 of the engineering team to go and fix tech debt so it doesn't become, you know, untenable, we do that. We've done it. And, but I struggle to say that's what you need to do, because there are a lot of early stage companies that actually can't do that or they won't survive. And so that's when I go to my cop out, which is, if you start with a strong foundation, right? If you start with a strong foundation and you make thoughtful trade-offs, you should be able to make the tech debt. It'll still accumulate and it'll still be meaningful, but hopefully not catastrophic.
Yeah. So thinking about your journey through a startup and thinking about maybe lessons learned, right? Like, what's some advice that you could give someone that's just getting into a startup or thinking about doing a startup? Like, what should they be thinking about?
Those are two very different, like, categories of advice. If you're thinking about doing a startup versus joining a startup. So I'm going to start with joining a startup. Maybe part two can be doing a startup.
Yeah.
Joining a startup, the first is only take the job if you really understand and believe that you can make security an enabler. Right. I mean, like, there's all sorts of different practitioners and they're all important. They all play an important role. Right. But you've got to be in an enablement mindset. You've got to be comfortable living in a risky environment. And it's really about what can you do in your capacity to minimize catastrophic risk to the business? It's a very different world in most startups than it would be if you're going to even like a 500 person company or a 1,000 person company or beyond. And so you're starting and you have to be comfortable working in an environment where you think you know what's happening and then 2 weeks later stuff changes. And so it's a lot of it's mental preparation and just understanding and being realistic about what you're strong at. If you're the type of person that, like, you know, is very philosophically, like, you just are morally tied to, like, everything needs to be buttoned up and perfectly secure, like, an early stage startup is not for you.
No.
It's never going to happen.
Yep. That's good advice. Yeah, maybe we can make the part two if we can get Kevin to join us to talk about the other one. But yeah, that's what I always said too. And, you know, joining a startup was, you know, if you don't like change, that's not for you, because things change constantly and people are coming and going and it's just, you know, very volatile. But that is the nature of a startup is.
Well, I don't know what startups you go to. It's Stavvy. People come, but not a lot of people go.
Oh, that's good.
We're very lucky.
You are very lucky.
Knock on wood.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. Just really happy to see your success. And sounds like you don't miss the security industry that much.
You know,
so that's
it. Like that, what you just said is not a true statement. In fact, you know what? Like, the security industry has lost a lot of people over the past 12 to 18 months, people that were in their prime.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think like my social life was, you know, basically the security industry growing up and through my entire career. So yeah. It's not that I don't miss the security industry. I miss it dearly. Right.
Yeah, fair enough. Yep.
It's more a function of, I think that in the security industry, unless you're at a very special company, it's very hard to really maximize the impact you can have as a human being on the place mm-hmm. that you're at. Right. In an industry where the organizational structure is such that your biggest wins are when nothing happens.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's the part I don't miss, but I miss the security industry.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard, like people, I don't know how it's changed. I honestly haven't been terribly involved in the industry in the past 5 years, but people that were involved in the security industry in the early 2000s through, you know, mm-hmm. The turn of the 2010s, like it was really like, I don't know that we'll ever, I don't like saying never, but I don't know that we'll ever see in technology an industry like that, because it was quite literally a bunch of kids and young adults that grew up knowing each other's handles. Right.
Yeah, that's true.
Before the time of Google. And then you ultimately like you got a job and now you could afford to like, you know, go to these conferences. And then you started to put like faces and names to these handles. Some people that you've known for 5 or 10 years, like since you were a teenager, in your early teens, like technology is never going to have, like, I don't know. I don't see a future, where like people that were born in the, you know, the mid-70s to the mid-80s, that got interested in security have experienced something that I think is incredibly unique and very improbable to be replicated.
Yeah.
So yeah, I miss a lot.
Yeah. And I think, like you said, the people, right? I don't know if we'll ever see, just because, like, you know, we were at the infancy of InfoSec, right? It was just really kind of a thing, right? That, and I think that all started when, you know, like Sarbanes-Oxley and, you know, like there was mandates now to create a security department and things kind of evolved from there. But yeah, like you, it's the same thing. I mean, I grew up, you know, a hacker, and that hacker culture I saw throughout my career kind of change and evolve. And, you know, people that I respected, I think of like Mudge and Weld Pond, you know, that were speaking in front of Congress about the internet is a dangerous place. And then next thing you know, Weld Pond, he became, you know, we created Veracode, right? And now all of us.
Now we call him Chris. Like,
what? Now we call him Chris, right? But that's what I mean is like, we're all now in positions where either starting companies or where, you know, like I'm an AVP, you know, in a company. And it's just so interesting now how we're seeing kind of this next generation. But this next generation is just so different. And nothing against the next generation. It's just very different than what our experience was.
Look, like one of my least favorite questions to get was basically from somebody that was trying to figure out how to get into security that was just coming out of college. Cause like, I don't know. Yeah. I never could answer that question. I was like, well, you have to understand for me, like, I don't know. I got curious about it when I was like 12. Right.
Yeah.
And there was no Google back then. So you used to have to like fuck with stuff and then like figure it out.
Yeah.
And then like you got really desperate. Like maybe you were going to like dial into a long distance BBS to like post a question about something, but that was rare because like, you know, my parents weren't going to be paying for long distance.
Nope.
And so, you know, like the way that we had to learn to problem solve and figure things out in an environment where everything was broken though. So like, you know, now when you're young, you can't just go like, let me start poking at this thing because, you know, there's probably vulnerabilities in it, but it's probably a lot harder to find.
Yeah.
But when you're 12 and you're starting and you're like, you know, I mean, it's very easy to like understand when like WinNuke exists or like overflows are when you can like crash people and you're a 12-year-old troll. Like it's, you know, you can start to build a like set of knowledge, right? That I don't know how you replicate anymore. And it is, it's truly fascinating. It really is. But I, you know, I think it's one of those things like, Mike passed away a few weeks ago, I posted something where it's like, you know, whenever somebody, that's been part of that community since really like the 90s informally and then beyond more formally, because as I used to say, my childhood hobby became a career field. It hurts extra deeply because like these are people who have a mindset and a knowledge and a way to approach problems that I don't know are replaceable, right? Not just as individuals, but as skill sets.
Yeah.
Even though they're also amazing humans. And there's this, I mean, I could talk for hours about the security community. So
yeah.
I do miss it. And I'm sitting here, I'm like, do I go to RSA or do I go to this Mizmo event, which is related to, like, you know, stuff that I'm doing for my startup. And I think I'm going to do Mizmo, but it's not going to be that much longer before I start going to some security events again.
Yeah. Well, you definitely should, because I'd love to see you at a conference sometime and hang out again. Those were great days, just hanging
our
out and
in our backs.
Oh my gosh, yeah, yeah, it's crazy. So how can our listeners follow you, find out more about what you're doing, and more about Stavvy?
Yeah, I mean, like in the olden days, I would be like, you know, I'd give them one of the handles. And
what's your handle? Yeah,
my handle is now Jay Feinblum.
Yes,
on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, also Finside Chats on Spotify, Apple, all the other podcasts. Not nearly as cool as this podcast, but we try. Honestly, like, LinkedIn is probably one of the best ways. Twitter's fine. I'm easy to find with a simple Google. So, yeah. You know, people feel free to reach out.
Well, thanks for coming on the show, Josh. We'll hopefully do part two when we get Kevin, maybe in a couple of weeks, but, really great, catching up, and, you take care.
You too, Tom.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share it with others, subscribe on your favorite podcast listening app, or leave us a rating and review. To catch all the latest from the show, visit our website, sharedsecurity.net, for all show notes and previous episodes. Follow us on Twitter at SharedSec and join our Reddit community on the Shared Security Show subreddit. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week for another episode of the Shared Security Show.